Okay, let's start.
It's in the word zoom.
Okay, welcome everybody. We resume our educational session. Welcome to the FASB staff who are with us very early at time. Who's going to kick off? Katrina?
Thank you, Dan. I really speak just to 30 minutes or possibly about 28 minutes at this point of education session. So in the interest of time, I'm just going to do a quick overview of both of the papers that we're going to discuss as part of the joint meeting later today, and then hand over to you for any questions or comments. Both of these papers are titled sweep issue papers, and that's because when we were here in July, of course, we told you you wouldn't be seeing us again, but here we are, because we have identified a few issues as we've started the process of drafting the re-exposure document. There are some issues that have arisen that we thought would be appropriate to come back and ask you to vote on. So today we've got papers 3A and 3B. Paper 3A deals with some questions that have arisen around the board's previous decisions on sale and leaseback transactions. And what we've done with this paper is, as I say, start from the previous decisions. Our plan is not to reopen the discussion again around how we think sale and leaseback transactions should be accounted for, but just to add some clarifications and just based on the questions that were asked. Paragraph 29 in paper 3A just summarise the recommendations. And those are that we think that when you come along and look at a sale and leaseback transaction and you're applying the revenue recognition guidance to work out whether there really has been a sale and therefore a leaseback, that you should kind of look at the whole transaction as a package. In saying that, we don't think that the existence of the leaseback alone should actually prevent sale accounting. So we still think that in the absence of anything else that would prevent sale accounting, according to the revenue recognition proposals, that you can still look at a sale and leaseback transaction as being the buyer lessor obtaining control of the underlying asset and then immediately deciding to transfer the right to control the use of that asset back to the seller for a period of time. Now, there are some situations, though, where something might be labelled a sale and leaseback where we think it would be inappropriate to get sale accounting, and that's basically in any situation where the leaseback, in a sense, it means that it's not really actually a sale and leaseback, it's more a sale and sealback. So any situation where the leaseback actually means that the seller would actually continue to have control of the asset, would continue to obtain substantially all of the remaining benefits. In that situation, we think there is no sale, because it's just like there's been a sale, and then immediately the seller's repurchased it. So then we think there isn't a sale, and we shouldn't get sale and leaseback accounting. And finally, what we are recommending is just a clarification around what you already decided, which is that if any transaction fails the sale criteria according to the revenue recognition proposals, that the entire transaction should be treated as a financing. And that clarification links into a question that's arisen, particularly in the context of sale and leaseback transactions, when there might be a call option included. And that call option might have a strike price below the original selling price. In that situation, I think if you strictly applied the words in the revenue recognition proposals, you could get to an outcome that would say you treat it as a lease and leaseback. And as we've looked through the accounting that would result from lease and leaseback accounting, we think, number one, it would be very complicated. And number two, the outcome wouldn't be particularly easy to understand or make sense or provide useful information. So in that sense, that's why we would say we think there's a clarification. If you fail sale accounting and revenue, then we think the whole transaction is a financing. So that's paper 3A.
Approved.
Do you want to take, or will I go on to 3B first, or no? Do we want?
Let's do 3A first.
Okay.
I have a question.
your new criteria. Basically, I like it. I think it is good because it is consistent with the, our new classification of the lease. That is fine. But if we give an impression that this is almost consistent with our new lease classification, it would be taken by constituents that the property lease is a default of SLE lease. And then, therefore, in the case of property lease, if there is a sales and leaseback place, then it's nearly automatically you can recognize sales. Because in the case of property lease, the default is SLE. That means you do not have a control. Okay. And then if sales and leaseback took place on the property, then basically if you sell to somebody and lease it back, then lessor has a control. It means lessor has control. So I have a little concern that it may drastically increase the case of sale and leaseback, which you can recognize profit at the point in time of sales.
I think there's a couple of things I'll just clarify from your question, which is useful, Tag. The first is that the guidance that we're doing here in terms of sale and leaseback would be, we'd intend that to apply to all leases. It wouldn't apply differently depending on whether it's a lease of property or of equipment. It would apply in exactly the same way. And I think that your conclusion that often if there is a sale and leaseback of property, equally as if there was of other equipment, well, obviously, depending on whether there are other features like call options, etc. But chances are that you know,
no call option.
Yeah, exactly. If there are no call, then chances are it's likely that the seller lessee might get sale accounted, and it'd be treated as a sale and leaseback. Now, whether that would increase the number of sale and leaseback transactions over today, my view is that it wouldn't necessarily compare to IS 17. I think it does change what happens today under US GAAP. Mm-hmm. And that's because under IS 17 today with sale and leaseback transactions, a seller lessee does get to recognize the sale when there is any sale and leaseback where the leaseback is an operating lease.
Yeah.
And it's just obviously the difference with our new proposals now is that seller lessee, yes, would get sale accounted, but he also has to recognize an asset and liability for the leaseback, which obviously he wouldn't do today. So my view is that you wouldn't necessarily get more accounting than we do today under 17.
Philippe?
Patrina, I'm okay with the proposals in paragraph 29. I'm struggling a little bit to understand the logic in paragraph 30. So assume that the criteria explained in 29 are not, or the criteria are met, so you pass the test, it is a sale. It is a sale and leaseback. Now let's consider the options. Two cases. The lessee, the original owner who becomes a lessee, has written a put to the lessor. The lessor can put it back. So we are back to square one. Or the lessee has a call option to buy back the asset, back to square one. But of course the risk is who has the control of that is not the same, whether it's a put or a call. What you are saying here is that if the entity can repurchase the asset, it is a call option, at below the original selling price, then it disqualifies as a sell and lease back, it is a financing arrangement. What is not clear here is what happens when there is a put option. If the new lessor has a put option, I don't understand how you deal with that here. Because you say those amendments will clarify that if an entity has an unconditional obligation, that is a put option, the entity should account for the contract as a lease, so it doesn't disqualify as a sell and lease back. Mm-hmm. It is still a sell and lease back. And then you go on saying, if the entity can repurchase the asset, it's not the put, it's a call option now. So I'm not clear about what happens with the put here.
I don't know. It depends on.
Actually, your paragraph has a series of proposals that follow each other, and in the end, it's not very clear.
In revenue, the put option doesn't preclude sale accounting, whereas the call, because we say control has transferred, because it's the buyer that has the put. But with the call option, the revenue ED said, effectively, the seller hasn't relinquished control, and it's either a financing transaction or it's a lease. So what this is dealing with, the situation when it's a lease, and then you've got the sort of sale and lease back, so you've got lease and lease back.
I find it very counterintuitive in a sale and lease back transaction that my counterparty can cancel this transaction because it has a put option on me at any price, any condition. We would say, no, it's still a good sale on lease back transaction. It's a fair transaction. And you introduce the notion of a price being below the original transaction only for the call option and not for the put. I don't see the logics of making a difference here. So it seems to me that if the my counterparty, because my lessor has a put option on me at a price which includes an incentive for him to do so, I would not think that the sale is really criteria is met.
But I think that Philippe, I mean, it's a fair point, and I think but that's something that's got to be considered in the context of revenue to say whether the guidance about the options is you know, whether it needs refining.
Yeah, but here it's a sell and lease back. Yeah, so I'm the only original owner of the asset. I do arrange something with a counterparty, but that counterparty has an incentive to put it back on me. So likely it will happen. So that really qualifies as a sell.
I just think, Philippe, and as I say, the boards can decide to go this. Just all we were trying to do was filter through and say, because the board's previous decision was that in the context of sale and leaseback, we won't create any special guidance for how we deal with, you know, sale and leaseback in the context, in terms of the sale, in the context of a sale and leaseback. If the board's deciding your situation, you don't, like the answer in a sense, then it would mean creating special guidance for sale and lease back. Whereas all we were trying to do was saying, look, in terms of working out whether you think there's a sale here, you're just following what the revenue recognition guidance is.
Are not you creating some special guidance in dealing with a call option? No,
because the reason we don't think so is because that's already not a sale according to revenue. If you've got a sales contract,
yeah,
exactly. So if you forget about the leaseback, any sales transaction where you've got a call option, you don't have a sale. Whereas any sales transaction with a put option, you can get a sale. So that's why we're not changing the sale accounting.
Yeah, but I would like you to think of the outcome of those combinations and whether the result is intuitive or counterintuitive, because the structuring opportunity to create a fictitious sell on leaseback transaction and giving total protection to your lessor by giving a put option on you, I think is a huge opportunity for structuring opportunities and hiding things which are in substance financing arrangements into a sell on leaseback. Pete, don't you think so? Structuring.
Any other comments? Continue with the next paper, then, please.
Yeah, so I'm just going to quickly tee up 3B, and then I'm just going to ask the authors, Colin and Lisa, if they have anything to add. In 3B, we have four issues, on sweep issues. There's two relating to lessees accounting under our single lease expense approach, and two relating to classification of leases. If I just quickly walk through that. Issue one in the paper is talking about how the accounting should work after impairment of a right of use asset. So this issue is not about actually how the impairment testing is done or how you work out the amount of the impairment. There we've decided you go to IAS 36 and you apply that. So you work it out in the same way as you would testing any other non-financial asset. It's just how do we think the accounting should work after you actually take an impairment loss. There's two situations addressed in the paper. The first is when the right of use asset is fully impaired. And we have a recommendation in the paper which we think is possibly the only way we thought of to go in terms of the answer, because when it's fully impaired, you no longer have an asset at all. So we think the income statement, therefore, should just reflect the unwinding of discount on the liability. When there's actually only partial impairment of the right of use asset, there are two possibilities. One is sort of included in paragraph 9 of the paper, which is to say that even though you've taken some impairment of the asset, we still think, you know, it would be appropriate to have a straight line expense. That's the pattern that best reflects these types of leases. It's just that, of course, because you've taken impairment, that straight line expense would be lower than it was before the impairment. The second alternative, which is the staff recommendation, is kind of follow what you do in full impairment in a sense. So even though it's only partial impairment, we think that, that taking that impairment sort of knocks you out of sort of straight line total expense accounting in a sense. And therefore, if you take any impairment on the right of use asset, the accounting that will continue after taking that impairment is that you're just kind of allocating the remaining carrying amount of the asset on a straight line basis and you're flowing through the unwinding discount and the liability. So that's issue one, two alternatives. I was just going to tee up all of them. Is that okay? issues two and three should be slightly less controversial, although perhaps not. Issue two is just trying to say that the previous board decision on the straight line expense approach was really that total expense would sort of must be and always be recognised on a straight line basis. The proposal in issue two is just to say, look, similar to how, for instance, operating lease accounting works today or even how typical amortisation method works, should we not say it must always be straight line, but you know we include an unless and other systematic basis is more representative. The one thing I'll just clarify here is in the question and in the recommendation, I think as staff we feel the question for you shouldn't be, should a lessee be permitted to recognise the lease expense on a straight line basis unless, it should actually be, should the lessee be required to recognise the lease expense on a straight line basis, unless another systematic basis is more representative. The third issue is just saying, okay, when you're classifying leases, when exactly do you have to classify leases? Is it only at commencement of the lease, or is there any, do we think you should be asked to reassess that classification at any point during the lease term? And issue four is then talking about classification when it's a sublease. And again, there's kind of two ways to go with issue four. One is that, according to how our sort of right of use model works, then, the underlying asset in a sublease is actually the right of use asset. And therefore, if we were strictly flowing that through, one way to go would say, look, when you're classifying that sublease, then the underlying is the right of use asset, and that's what you should look to. The recommendation in the paper as the other alternative would actually says, look, for the purposes of classification, and when you're looking at that, we actually think you should look through to the ultimate asset being leased, so whether that's the building, whatever else, as opposed to the right of use asset. And the main reason for that recommendation is kind of linked to some sort of simplicity arguments and what might be a bit simpler to apply and practice. So with that, over to questions. Sorry, I should have asked Colin or Lisa, do you have anything to add to that?
Colin? No, I think that was a good summary, Patrina.
Okay. A plus. Patricia.
I'm not sure I agree with any of the staff recommendations for issues here, because they all seem to me in one way or another to violate what I understood to be the underlying conceptual basis for the SLE approach. Particularly the one that says they're required to use straight line unless another pattern better reflects the value to be derived from the underlying asset, because in the straight line approach, you're not supposedly consuming any of the underlying assets. So what difference does the underlying asset make? And that's sort of the same problem I have with the other two recommendations as well. Why are we even looking at the underlying asset?
So you're referring to, I think, issue one, issue two, and issue four?
Yes.
Paul? I'm in the exact same issue, the same position as Patricia. Where I really, I guess, need to be educated in this education session is if we say a lease is substantially different from the acquisition of an asset, which I never have understood that argument, but that's the argument for the straight line method, that we can net the asset liability, amortize the net of those on a straight line basis because somehow a lease is different. Why are we looking to the underlying here? My main concern is issue two, your question two. I do have the same issue in four. One and three I could accept. But I've got a, I'd like to make, I look at your, let me make one more point. I look at required unless or permit unless very much like an optional, an accounting alternative. By changing permit to require, what you've done is you've changed the default. But once you're forced looking to the underlying, then you almost automatically will get, you cannot lead, that can't lead you to straight line. Because the underlying, right now under your straight line method is increasing charge depreciation. I think you're going to be very hard pressed, as we are under IAS 16, IAS 38 today, to justify increasing charge depreciation. So when you say look to the underlying, I think you're going to force walking away from straight line to some sort of front ending. I'd be very happy with that because I didn't care for the straight line method in the first place. But I don't think you've got this proposal, particularly in question two, is consistent with the basis that we agreed in June for going with the SLE method. So that's my view.
More than a sweep issue, it seems to be a sweeping issue.
Yeah, I agree with that, Hans.
Tak.
Yes, just quickly, I have concern on issue four. I think it's a good idea. However, what if the company has a kind of back-to-back sublease? You have same term and almost same amount, same value, and sublease it. In that case, if we go down the road of your proposal, then the headless lessor should keep recognizing right of use assets.
That's right.
And yeah, that's fine. However, isn't there any way to introduce the concepts of principal or agent? So if the case like I described, the company is just doing back-to-back sublease, in that case, they are acting as an agent rather than, lessee. So isn't there any possibility that we introduce the concept of agent of sublease?
I think that would possibly contradict your previous decisions about how subleasers are treated, because what we agreed before was that in a sublease situation, you account for the head lease and the sublease separately, because obviously there's just one party, one party to those transactions is the same, but the counterparty to each of those transactions is different. But I think you do highlight one important thing to say about issue four, which is if you go with the staff recommendation, it is true, though, that, for instance, if I as a lessee lease, a building from Paul for 5 years and I immediately sublease it to UTAC for that full 5 years, our recommendation would mean that I would still keep the the right of use asset on my books, and that might be, you know, something that might drive you to say, well, I prefer the alternative, because in that case, I think, you know, you haven't got the right of use anymore, and it's actually better to, you know, for me as the sub, you know, sub lessor in a sense, to no longer have the right of use.
Are you talking about scenario tech in which you as an agent actually don't have a liability for that lease once you have subleased it? Because what Katrina was explaining and what we were recommending is that if you have true liability, then that should continue to be recognized. But if the arrangement is actually structured as a head lease and sublease, but not actually a lease in the first instance, then your accounting might apply. Is that what you were thinking?
I understand that there is a liability. And even in the case of back-to-back lease businesses. So therefore, I think even in that case, we should recognize right of use asset. But at that time, we didn't have this kind of idea. And then in that case, if you have a back-to-back sublease, then you could deem it as if you sold right of use asset. Then you could, you know, you would go into the residual and receivable model. So then, in that case, it's reasonable. However, if you go down the road here, you stay on the SLE type, and you keep right of use asset as it is. It's, to me, it's a little bit counterintuitive, because you have right of use asset on your balance sheet, and then sublessee, final lessee, has a right of use here. So to me, it's a little bit strange.
Just quick comment. Petrina said that I was the original owner of that property. She leased from me. She subleased it then on to you. I refuse to let her off the hook. She owes me for her lease to me. What she did with it with TOC is another issue. That's why that liability, I think I want it on your balance sheet. I want you to acknowledge that you owe me that.
Exactly. And you've got that and right by the way, under both of the possible alternatives under issue 4, I will absolutely have the liability. There's no question about me having the liability. The only question is potentially about whether I keep the right of use and my profile of income on the transaction with TAC.
Okay. It's only derecognizing the right of use.
Yeah, exactly. So the only difference between the possible alternatives under issue 4 is whether I derecognize the right of use and my income, you know, my income profile from the transaction with TAC, I will always keep the liability that I have with you.
You do have a receivable on your books.
Yeah.
And possibly a right of use. So if you have a receivable, you have a liability because this receivable is not yet fully earned. You have a liability for performance obligation.
So let's.
You are the intermediate lessor. You have a sublease with TAC, and you have a lease from Paul. So what you have is a receivable from TAC on your books, and
not definitely.
Well, okay. Let's assume it's folded. A receivable and residual, and you have a liability, and you have to Paul a liability and a right of use. So we have two liabilities. One to Paul and one to Paul.
No. The alternative. So let's take a 5-year building example, and let's assume that 5-year lease would fall and would be classified so that, you know, if it was just when I lease it from Paul, that 5-year lease falls under our single lease expense approach, and then I sublease it for 5 years. The alternatives is that if you go with the staff recommendation. Then what I would have is that as the lessee, I would recognize a right of use asset for the 5-year lease and a lease liability. And in terms of the transaction with TAC, I would treat it like an operating lease today. So I would keep the right of use asset on my books and I would just recognize rental income from TAC over the lease term. So that's the staff recommendation. If we went with the alternative, in issue 4, what would happen is I would initially recognize the right of use asset and the lease liability, but then when I transact with TAC, I would de-recognize the right of use and I would replace it with a receivable residual. Or in that case, there would be no residual. So I'd replace the right of use with a receivable. So the question is just over the asset and the timing of or sort of the profile and classification of income.
We would, we have scheduled a break, a lunch break at this time. Shall we just continue now or finish this?
Is 2:15, is it the FASB, the joint meeting after the lunch, or is it only...
Yeah, this is the joint meeting is happening this afternoon. Meeting.
And that's with...
On it's the decision making, yeah.
See, on this one, right?
Oh, okay.
So it is decision making this afternoon.
Education session.
No. This is education. This afternoon is decision making joint meeting.
So now we are already spreading the decision making over 2 weeks?
Yes.
Yes.
Well,
because the FASB were only available very short hours next week, so we made part of the weekly meeting this week to fill in all the joint discussions.
Okay. All right, let's try to finish this educational session. Who?
Daryl was before me.
Daryl, please, yes.
I was just very uncomfortable with the, in fact, I disagree with the staff recommendation with regard to partial impairment. And I disagree with it because if I'm understanding it correctly, what we're saying under partial impairment scenario is if a lessee believes that they are paying too much on a lease, all that has effectively changed is their expectation of what the appropriate price is. What we would compel them to do in that circumstance is to recognize the impairment, take the expense, and that's fine, that makes sense to me. But then in addition, we compel them to change the way on which they're accounting for the lease. So they now no longer account for the lease as an SLE lease, they account for the lease as a traditional lease or as an alternate basis. The problem with that is a couple of fold. The first thing is that the underlying nature of the lease has not changed. So there's no reason to account for the lease differently other than the recognition of an impairment. The second problem is that the expense that you now put through the income statement is prohibitively high. It recognizes both the impairment, which is appropriate, but it also recognizes the alternative approach, which is a high front-end expense profile. It seems to me that those two elements that you're picking up as expense are going to serve as a deterrent for recognizing the impairment in the first place. And it doesn't seem to me that that's appropriate because our argument here is that nothing has changed in the underlying lease, nothing has changed in the nature of the lease, but we've changed the accounting for it. I recognize there's some issues, and we probably don't have time to discuss why we got to this answer, but I don't think the answer is right.
PK?
Sorry, Colin.
Oh, did you want?
Sorry, Colin, maybe just one second.
Please.
Daryl, when we were thinking through this issue, at least my initial thought was the same as yours, that the accounting answer for a partial impairment should be different than a full impairment for the reasons that you describe. But the reason the staff ultimately went a different direction than your view was a couple of things. One is that if you went down your path of having a different answer for partial and full impairment, then you'd have to be comfortable with a scenario where, let's say, you have a full impairment where the right-of-use asset is written down to zero, and then you have an impairment where the right-of-use asset is written down to, let's say, you know, £1 or £10. You'd have a very different answer, even though the economic substance is about the same. So you'd have to be comfortable with that if you had two different approaches for impairment. And then the other thing is, if you went down your path for a partial impairment, then you'd also have to be comfortable that in order to achieve straight line on an ongoing basis, there would be circumstances where you may actually need to write up the asset, where the right of use asset is, you know, this balancing figure. So you'd sort of have to write up the asset to achieve straight line, but then you might immediately be impairing it again. So ultimately, we thought it might be a simpler answer to have the impairment approaches be the same.
I probably don't disagree with what you're saying in terms of the complexities of it. I think the problem is it doesn't change the fact that for me it's the wrong answer. And just to pick up on the two issues, to my mind there is a fundamental difference between any partial impairment and a full impairment. If you have a full impairment, you actually don't have a lease anymore because you don't ascribe any value to that asset. Whereas if you have a partial impairment, even if it's a substantial partial impairment, you do continue to have a lease, you continue to have an underlying right of use asset. And the only difference is that you've changed the acceptable pricing for that lease. And so to my mind, the underlying fundamentals of the lease have remained in place in the second example. They're gone in the first example.
The second point is with regard to the asset value and the peculiarity that we have when we get into an SLE lease type is determining what that underlying asset value is in the first place. Because the underlying asset value, to my mind, is the representation of the straight line expense that I believe is appropriate for the benefit I'm receiving over the life of the asset. In that case, if the asset value has to be slightly higher in order to get the appropriate expense profile, then I think that is actually consistent with our definition of SLE. And if you have a look at any normal SLE profile versus a regular lease profile, you actually do end up with a higher asset value in the beginning years than you would, and that makes sense because you're effectively deferring some of that interest expense to the later part of life. So this increased asset value, I think, is consistent with the underlying SLE model.
I mean, there is an alternative as well. I mean, if, by the way, and it's only if the board's decided they agreed with Daryl's thoughts, there is an alternative potentially to actually, you know, a situation where you'd have to write up the asset. You could decide to go that route and actually say the amount of expense taken can never be lower than the interest or unwinding of discount on the liability. So, I mean, there's a potential way of dealing with that we could just, you know, prevent the situation where you'd be writing up the asset.
PK.
I think you touched on the point that I was trying to make, Petrina, is that if you, first of all, let me understand dial back, although I have been vehemently opposing it, but let me ask you a question. Your underlying basis for recognizing a straight line, quote unquote, straight line lease expenses to match with the cash payments.
Well, that's
forget about the uneven payment situation, but the idea was that people were saying that I want my lease expense to be equal to my cash expense.
Well, I think because they were saying that they felt that was a better reflection of economically what they were paying for.
It will be a surprise to you. I might be supporting you, so don't oppose me right away.
I'm not disagreeing.
So the question I have is that the moment you have a full impairment, let's take the easy case, the cash payments are not going to match with the expense unless you write up the asset, which I provided you examples, and I'm sure you came up with your own examples on that. Unless you write up the asset, you will not get to this situation of straight line matching with cash. So, and what is the basis for writing up an asset? It will never be there. So I think on that basis, I support the staff to do, once there is a full impairment, to go down the model of just the interest to be recognized through the income statement. Now, come to the partial impairment for a second. I thought through, there are a couple of partial impairments. Substantially partial impairment, like there's only $1 left or $2 left in that. Partial impairment where there's a half left. So with different scenarios can lead to a different answer. The point I wanted to understand is, what do you mean by partial? It could be, if I have left $1 left in the asset value, it's still partial. Yeah. The question is that it's substantially partial or not. I think you need to think about whether this cut you made between the full impairment and partial impairment is too blunt a cut. That's what I want to suggest to you. On the subleases, along with my fellow board members, I'm getting confused between ROU asset and underlying asset. When do I need to use it? We have been using it very inconsistently, so I don't support that. So, but I support your one, because that's only, unless you write up the asset, you cannot mathematically do anything else.
I'll just clarify one thing on issue one, that just your comments drew out, PK, which is on issue one, which is how do you do the accounting after the impairment? Yeah, depending on whether you've only got $1 of impairment or you've got full impairment except $1, clearly is very, very different. And probably if we wanted to have some wonderful, great answer, we could within partial impairment, we could have any number of boxes. So, in fact, the two alternatives, there really isn't a perfect answer, because if you go with the staff recommendation, then, yes, you get more consistency if there's, you know, full impairment and, you know, 100 100% impairment or 99%, but you get very different accounting in that situation if there's no impairment versus 1% impairment. The opposite is true if you went with the alternative in paragraph 9. So, to me, there isn't one that's...
Can I just make a statement on that, though? If I take... PK's example together with what you suggested earlier, if you've written it down to $1, then the expense, the flatline expense you're going to recognize over the next 5 years is one-fifth of $1 per year. Okay, that's what you've got to get back to. But you put the rider on that it can never be less than the interest, which actually means you're getting the appropriate answer. If I'm taking that, I think that actually works out, even for the write down to $1. If you've just written down 1% of it, it probably doesn't impact on the interest. So you will figure out whatever the straight line number is that we should be getting. So I think your suggestion actually does get to that, to the right answer, even in a substantial write down scenario.
Do you think through that? I think my solution is more imminent than all these things.
We go.
Very simple comments, not directly related to the proposals and the questions.
Oh.
You know, some people will favor or propose a straight line because it's simpler, you know, looks like so building. But if you want to go deep into further, you will find, you know, it seems much complicated. And then this is the reason why, from the beginning, PK and I permanent against.
Can I just, we have to come to a conclusion of this meeting. This question two, I really don't get it. First of all, the analogy is made with the possibility to diverge from straight line depreciation. The SOE approach, its departure point is not straight line depreciation. So it has a very different departure.
You mean impairment?
No.
Impairment is not the departure.
No. I'm talking about question issue two. And secondly, I don't indeed see how you can get to the CLE, to get close to the CLE approach, another systematic basis would be more representative. So it is.
Maybe it's worth just clarifying our intentions with issue two. Our intentions were simply to make the words sort of consistent with the day. We had no intention. We actually think in practice everybody's going to be recognizing it all straight line anyway, irrespective of whether we put in these words. So to be honest, if you end up telling us that you think that just complicates things and you want to just stick to it always being straight line, we didn't think we were changing anything. It was just a wording thing. So,
and this is straight line expensing of the combination of
That's
interest
right.
and the asset.
That's right. And our intention was
very, it's very different from the depreciation rules on which is straight line depreciation of the asset only and not of including interest. So the analogy is completely wrong.
Was there a fact pattern that you heard in mind?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think more, and by the way, in the paper when we link in and talk about maybe compared to like depreciation methods today, that's a bit of a red herring and we shouldn't have mentioned that. It's more the link was probably more into operating lease accounting today and the fact that on paper operating lease accounting today, you know, an operating lessee, it says, you know, you're required to recognise that operating lease expense on a straight line basis unless another systematic basis is more representative of your use of the asset. And that's all we were trying to carry through. I mean, in practice, I've never seen other than straight line operating lease expense, and I don't know of anyone else who has, which is why, well, you have, sorry.
For inflation.
Okay, yeah.
Inflation adjusted.
Yeah, but, you know, which is why, as I say, we were just trying to be, I suppose, consistent with what operating lease accounting says today. We didn't necessarily think this was a very fundamental change, but if it is more than that, or it could be misinterpreted as being more than that, then.
But the wording is unfortunate because you said permitted unless, it should be required unless, and I think Paul made the point.
Yeah.
The default is required unless.
Yeah, it should say required, the paper should say required.
Anyway, okay. I think we need some time for lunch. And we reconvene at 2:50. Thank you.
Thank you. No walk.
Thank you.
I don't know.
I'll check the bottom.